You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Once upon a time, there was a man named Jonah. He was content, sipping his latte at the local coffee house, minding his own business, happy in the assurance that God loved him and accepted him, and all was right with the world. He was Jewish, after all. What's not to like? But then, the voice of God said, "Jonah, go to Nineveh and set those foreigners straight." So he immediately got up and went in the complete opposite direction. He went down to Tel Aviv and bought a ticket to Tarshish, which was a common euphemism for as far away as possible. And he set off by boat, which should tell you just how desperate he was. Jews were not known as great seafarers. He was willing to take quite a risk to get away from God. Well, you know the story. The sea kicks up, Jonah gets thrown overboard, swallowed by a great fish, and after 3 days is vomited up on the beach. That's about it, yeah? At least for most of us, that's the story that makes the storybooks. But that's not the point. In fact, if that's all you know of Jonah, it probably would have been better that you didn't have it cluttering up your brain at all. The real story begins next, when you read some of what Harold Beck calls the most beautiful words in the Bible. "Then the word of the Lord came to Jonah a second time." Another chance. But Jonah was still not happy about it. He had his suspicions about God and said so. He worried that he was just going to end up looking stupid, going and warning the Ninevites of God's impending punishment, and then God would probably turn around and decide not to punish them, even though everybody knows these foreigners deserve every punishment that can be meted out. Sure enough, Jonah calls them to repent, and they do. Everybody puts on sackcloth and ashes, right down to the cattle. And that's a lot funnier with a Yiddish accent. And God changes God's mind. It's right there in the text. God repents and decides to forgive them. Well, this is Jonah's worst nightmare. He puts his reputation on the line and warns the people of certain doom, and dang it, God forgives them, these foreigners. So Jonah does what any self-respecting prophet would do. He goes up on a mountain and pouts.
Our words of wisdom are from the book of Jonah, chapter 3, verse 10, through chapter 4, verse 3.
When God saw how the Ninevites turned from their evil ways, God repented of the evil he said he would do to them, and he did not do it. But this is very displeasing to Jonah, and he was angry. He prayed to the Lord and said,
"O Lord, is not this what I said while I was still in my country? That is why I fled to Tarshish at the beginning, for I knew that you are a gracious God and merciful, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love, and ready to relent from punishing. And now, O Lord, please take my life from me, for it is better for me to die than to live."
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
"O Lord, please take my life from me, for it is better for me to die than to live."
What a whiner. Now, there's a little more to this story, but you get the idea. What is really going on here has nothing to do with whale vomit and everything to do with the grace of God poured out on everyone, regardless of race, faith, borders, or any other boundaries you can think of. This may not seem like a radical thing to you, but to those hearing Jonah for the first time, it was downright subversive. Why? Because in Jonah's day, everybody believed that the world worked in a certain way. In fact, most everybody believes the world works exactly that same way, even today. It is so ingrained in us that we don't even know we believe it, but we do. We eat, breathe, and live it every single day. And here it is. You get what you deserve, and you deserve what you get. You've heard of the book of Deuteronomy. Well, in fancy theologian talk, this principle is called the Deuteronomic Code. The poor are poor, and those who are suffering suffer because they've done something to offend God, or their parents did something, or their parents' parents. Their lot in life is a punishment from God. On the other hand, the rich are rich and the comfortable are well off because they're so good and God just loves them so much that they're being rewarded. This subconscious belief system is the primary operating software in most of our noggins. It allows us to blow off the poor because obviously they deserve their lot. Who are we to get between them and God's punishment? It allows us to feel self-righteous and smug in our relative wealth because our comfort is a clear sign that God likes us. It only gets tripped up when something tragic happens in our lives. And the only thing we can think to ask is, what did I do to deserve this? So the book of Jonah is in the Bible as protest literature, criticizing this way of thinking. It was written to undermine the status quo. If you take nothing else away from this blathering, remember this. Jonah is not the hero of this story. He's an incompetent, ungrateful jerk. He's a stand-in for all those people who believe that because of their race, status, religion, sexual orientation, or any other category, God loves them. And everybody else is on God's enemy list. Jonah is supposed to be a sad joke, and the proper response to his plight is that of pity for someone who is so narrow-minded that they just can't fathom the breadth of God's love.
Well, if that's the case, then how do you explain Matthew 16:4? Jesus is confronted by those who want him to prove who he is, and he responds with, "An evil and adulterous generation asks for a sign, but no sign will be given to it. Zip, nada, nothing, except the sign of Jonah." Then he left them and went away. Huh? No signs except the sign of Jonah? I can't tell you how many well-meaning people I've heard butcher this passage and then point back to Matthew 12, where Matthew has Jesus predict his own death and resurrection.
Well, it's in Jesus' own words that the sign of Jonah is that both Jonah and Jesus were swallowed up in death for 3 days and then vomited up to new life?
No. Evidently, Matthew knows even less about Jonah than he knows about virgin birth. The sign of Jonah has nothing to do with death and resurrection, and everything to do with short-circuiting the Deuteronomic code of you get what you deserve, and you deserve what you get. I've been doing this long enough now that if you pressed me, I might just say that Jesus' whole ministry and most of his teachings are aimed at overturning and undermining this one idea. You get what you deserve, and you deserve what you get. And how did he do it? With humor, story, irony, metaphor, and short sayings, all of which were used to make his audience think for themselves. It was a technique that was rabbinic, to be sure, but even more specifically, it was typical of wisdom teachers. The wisdom tradition is often associated with the mystical or spiritual aspects of various faith traditions. It helps people work through the whys of life without resorting to shallow, pat answers. Wisdom literature is concerned about the meaning of life, mostly by an appeal to experience. As Bill Nelson used to say, wisdom is more than intelligence, but includes it, more than knowledge, though it needs it, and more than information, though it often depends upon it. It's not very concerned with traditional religious thought, because traditional religious thought is often the product of dualistic thinking. Who's in? Who's out? What's right and what's wrong? All or nothing. With me or against me? Up or down? Either or. It's the root of family strife, racism, church squabbles, gridlock in Washington, and in all its glory, war. Many of you have heard me talk about one of my spiritual mentors, a Franciscan priest, Father Richard Rohr. On one of his visits to Phoenix, he talked about dualistic and non-dualistic thinking. He said that dualistic thinking has its place. After all, it's made the Enlightenment possible with science and economics and modern democracy. But when it comes to comprehending the subtle degrees between, say, tall and short and good and bad, it completely breaks down. Jesus' whole approach was to short-circuit dualistic thinking with questions, parables, and stories, all of which make people think, talk, and wrestle with ambiguity. Life is simply not black and white. I love what Brandon Scott has to say about folks who aren't comfortable with ambiguity. He says, they're really stuck. They've got a lot of things they can't do. They can't read poetry, they can't read novels, and they can't watch TV. They can't read the Gospels. They've really cut themselves off. They're really reduced to reading lawyers' texts. A lawyer is a person who thinks ambiguity is a bad thing. So you try to define the contract or the will so that nobody can break it. Well, even legal texts are ambiguous. That's why you have to go to court and solve them. So it doesn't work. Part of the problem is, if you really think things have simple meanings, then we have to have interchangeable brains so that we have exactly the same experience, exactly the same meaning. That doesn't happen. So, into a world striving to make everything black and white, into a religious climate of you get what you deserve and you deserve what you get, comes this Jesus character, purveyor of wisdom, embracer of ambiguity. And these one-liners, these zingers, like, God makes the sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and unjust. Wait, what? We have a God who doesn't discriminate? And why should we be surprised by this? Asks Jesus. Jesus also said, blessed are the poor. He said, what? In a world that believes you get what you deserve and you deserve what you get, that's outrageous. And in Greek, what Jesus said is even worse. Blessed are the beggars, the destitute. How could that possibly be? Aren't riches and wealth a reward for living a righteous life? What on earth does Jesus mean? It short circuits the status quo. It gets under your skin. It irritates you. And maybe you conclude, they're the oppressed ones, so at least they're not guilty of oppression. They're innocent. They're not the ones doing the oppressing. And then somebody else argues back, that doesn't make any sense. But there you go. You're thinking, you're engaged with other people on matters that are important. And so, over 2,000 years later, we're still engaged with this Jesus, this voice of wisdom that can only be called subversive. It undercuts the status quo. It moves beyond conventional wisdom of black and white simplicity into the often ambiguous world of the Spirit. Let me be clear. This is not some esoteric babble about a pie-in-the-sky idea. It has very real implications for our lives right here and now. Politicians and churches across the country are promoting what is called Christian nationalism, what would better be called what it truly is, white Christian nationalism, with one goal in mind, to take power and impose their narrow, fundamentalist Christian way of thinking on everyone else. If Jesus were asked, he would laugh in their faces. He was dealing with the same religious nationalists in his day. They just happened to be Jewish. These people are banning books, criminalizing transgender people, colluding with those who believe more gun violence is the solution to our problems, and choking off women's reproductive rights. Last week, the Southern Baptist just kicked one of their largest churches, Saddleback, out of their denomination. Why? Because they had the audacity to ordain a woman as a pastor. Their entire agenda is driven by fear and the threat of punishment. They don't know any other way. And that's because they're a bunch of Jonahs. They blindly embrace their unearned privilege as something ordained of God because, like Jonah, they're so righteous. And they look down on anyone not like them as obviously deserving of punishment from God, or from them if God hasn't gotten around to it yet. After all, you should get what you deserve, and you deserve what you get, right? Do you remember the old saw? There are two kinds of people in the world. Those who think there are two kinds of people in the world and those who don't. Well, since most of us are dualistic thinkers, let me suggest that it finally comes down to two ways of approaching the spiritual life. Being motivated by privilege, guilt, and fear, Jonah, or being motivated by love and compassion. Compassion being justice acted out in the world. That would be Jesus. The status quo, the Deuteronomic code, you get what you deserve and you deserve what you get, is all about privilege, guilt, and fear of punishment. And then there's Jesus' message of divine ambiguity, a deep wisdom centered on grace, love, and compassion. The question is, who are you going to follow? Jonah or Jesus? What's it going to be? Rules? Walls? Rigidity? Demonizing others? Pouting? Or grace upon grace? Now, don't get me wrong. What I'm suggesting is not easy. It's not popular within what passes for respectable Christianity in our culture. It's challenging, it's risky, and it busts up most people's happy little categories of right and wrong, good and bad, and us versus them. But if you're paying attention, when was Jesus ever on about promoting happy little categories? Jesus was a teacher of wisdom. His stories, sayings, and teachings say it over and over again. It's not about victory. It's not about punishment. It's not about rewards. It's not about what you deserve or what you get. It's about looking on reality with compassion, love, inclusivity, and forgiveness. Recognizing everything as created by God, infinite in dignity, and to be honored by loving kindness, doing justice, and walking humbly with God. The wisdom tradition is less about answers as it is about learning what questions to ask. It's less about judging the guilty than engaging with the issues that deeply affect real people. It's less about protecting the status quo and more about being open to new possibilities. It's a journey that you travel with trusted companions your whole life long. And as Jesus taught and lived, it's about a surprising and transforming grace that humbles the powerful and empowers the humble. Go and do likewise. Be well.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.wepuTloveFirst.org.